Hey guys, Kyle here with a quick note before we get into the interview with Micah. Around the 42-minute mark, he goes into the backstory of his poem/song Freak Show. And with that comes a conversation around 11 minutes of him discussing specific sexual crimes and those who commit them. It's a challenging conversation. It's a, I think, really good conversation, but nonetheless, I recognize it's not something that everyone might want to listen to and or might not be beneficial to their soul and heart and mind. So that's why I've included this note. If you want to know the time to skip that section, I've included it in the show notes. So just look there and you'll see the different timestamps. But without any further ado, here is the interview. It's one of my favorites, and I hope you guys dig it. Welcome to another episode of Humming Fools. I am one of your hosts, Kyle Stuck, and I'm joined by my co-host and escargot-loving friend, Noah Bosley.
What's going on?
Noah, I will tell you, today is probably one of my favorite days that has ever occurred, ever. You want to know why, Noah?
Why, Kyle?
I'm sure you don't know. It's because we have Micah Borne in our studio with us today. Micah, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, man, it's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
If you haven't been following the show for a long time, which is very probably the case.
Seeing as where it has not existed for a long time.
Yes. Thank you for breaking that down, Mike.
It's kind of impossible.
Yes.
I've been listening for 2 years myself.
our name, this whole thing was inspired by Micah. And part of that is attributed to someone else. We get into that in our episode, but a big part of it was Micah. And I never thought that we would actually be able to get him in the studio and talk to him. So it's such an honor to have you here on our show inspired by you. It's a weird awesome, feeling.
Yeah, it's a little surreal.
I'm a little sweaty. I'm a little misty eyed, but enough about me, Micah. Could you tell the people, our listeners, just a little bit about yourself and what you do?
Yeah, I used to be a huge Kanye fan.
Oh, no. You guys missed the whole preamble to that before we started recording.
What the heck?
I made the mistake of asking a very loaded question.
Oh, man, he going to bring up Kanye and then be like, no, we're not going to talk about it on the air. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? We don't have to, but I just need to let you know that I used to be a huge Kanye fan. Anyway, I'm from Long Beach, California, born and raised in the West Coast. I love it out there. But yeah, I am a creative writer. I am most known for my spoken word poetry, but I write in a lot of different genres. My first form of writing actually was hip hop. I was rapping for a couple of years before I wrote anything else. Then I got into poetry, and then from there I just started meeting a lot of other artists, a lot of musicians, and started writing with other people and for other people. So I'm a songwriter for other vocalists, and so that could be any genre, you know, anywhere from folk to pop to gospel, bluesy stuff. And so it's fun. It's a challenge. I'm just constantly trying to push myself to try new things. I'm a creative, and I love being around other creatives. And for me, creativity, it really changed my life. I didn't grow up creative. I grew up more into athletics, played a lot of sports. And I struggled in school. I thought I was dumb most of elementary through high school because I wasn't smart in the traditional sense. I did very poorly in math and science. And, you know, that's what it meant to be smart, you know, getting good grades in math and science and getting high test scores on the standardized tests and things like that. And those were all the things I was bad at. You know, I'm one of six kids. My siblings were brilliant. I was the only person in my family to ever fail a class. I failed algebra. And it really wasn't until I started engaging my creativity in college that I, for the first time, felt like I was intelligent. You know, people the way they started responding to my music and my poetry, they're like, oh man, you know, you're smart or you're deep or that was profound. And I was like, really? Like, nah, like, cause I always felt stupid. And anyway, so just having that story, I'm so passionate about helping other people discover their creativity, because I often think, man, what would have happened in my life if I would have realized that I wasn't stupid at a younger age, if I would have realized the importance of creativity at a younger age. And you know, I know it's cliche, but they always say that, you know, I think they attribute it to Einstein, like, you know, if you judge a fish by its ability to climb a tree, you'll think it's stupid, you know? And it's like, that's kind of how I felt. Like I was just, I couldn't measure up to the kind of typical way that we measure intelligence in America, and therefore thought I was dumb. But I wasn't, and I just hadn't discovered the way my intelligence expressed itself, mainly through creativity. And when I say that, I don't limit it just to the traditional arts like, you know, poetry or singing or dancing, but I think everyone is creative. It's part of being human. And even in things that are not typically seen as creative things like math and science, you know, I say, you know, the best mathematician is good at math because they're creative, because they look at the same problem that most other people look at and say there's no answer. And they think, I can think of four or five different ways to approach this to try to figure it out. And so their mind has to go to creative places. And so I just find developing people's creativity, helping people discover the creativity inside them, is one of the best things you could do for a person. And so that's what I'm passionate about. Yeah.
Wow.
Well, speaking of making or helping people find their creativity, I wanted to first start off with a quick affirmation on that note for you. Again, just the thing that makes this whole experience and you being here so cool is beyond just, you know, being a fan of you and you contributing to our name. I remember when I first was introduced to you, which was in college, listening to your spoken word album, Alive in Three. There's a song on there called, what is it? Confident Uncertainty. And in that, you're kind of talking with life, kind of having this back and forth. And at that time, I was beginning working on my film, like what would be my senior project. And that song was a breakthrough for me, because I was trying to figure out how to have death manifest itself. And it ultimately, I was like, oh, it's like there should be banter between the main character / me and death. I know in your song it's life, but that last line where it talks about life, you know, being at the door, and you're asking, like, you know, like, where are we going? And he says, only God knows. Like, again, it's just a little thing, but it was a click for me. And that's what's so cool is, like you said, just your intelligence, your creativity, inspiring others. And it's just for you, the goal's not to, in that song necessarily, like, oh, this is going to help someone write a film, but it all bleeds into each other. Yeah. And so, I remembered that today. I was like, oh my gosh, like, I forgot that that's where I got this character was from one of your songs. Yeah. So anywho.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Like, the goal isn't one particular thing, but it's unlocking things in people that can lead to who knows where, you know, and that's kind of what that whole track is about. You know, confident uncertainty is somewhat of an oxymoron, right? Usually confidence comes from people who know, who are certain about things they want to do, or they think they're certain about the path of their future. And so they feel confident because I have it all laid out. But to have confidence in the uncertainty of life, I think is the goal, because even people who think they're confident, they don't actually know what will happen. You know, you can have a great plan for your life, and 9 times out of 10, it's not going to go exactly how you plan it. And even people who are like, I know exactly what's going to happen, and you know, there, you can have the best plan you want to. But there's a part in that poem that say, you know, I forgot to plan for the things you can't plan for, you know? And it's like, I had a plan, but so many things happened that were completely out of my control. My junior year of college, I got diagnosed with ulcerative colitis, and it's a long, complicated sickness, but it has literally changed the course of my life, you know? But when I was a freshman picking a major, deciding, when I was a junior thinking about what I want to do after I graduate, I wasn't like, and then, you know, first semester junior year, I'm going to get a chronic illness. And, you know, yeah. it's mm-hmm. like, you know, it's just like you can't plan those things. So you have to figure out a way to have peace, to trust, and to roll with the punches. And I don't think if you think you know, and if you feel like you have to control everything to have peace, you'll never have peace. Or it'll be short-lived because you'll soon find out that life has all kinds of surprises, and that's not a bad thing. So yeah, I think the best thing you can learn to do is roll with the punches and just learn to trust God with it all. But and no shade, Lil Homie, is really difficult to see based on the cover, but the album is actually called Alive and Ill.
No,
I was like Alive and Three, bro.
I was gonna say something, but I don't know. We'll edit it later.
Yeah, no,
for real, bro.
No.
I say it in the album too, but only once. But
my shame has to be displayed.
You know, ILL. It does. You know, it does look like Roman numeral
so,
three.
In your defense, on Spotify, they're all the same character. It looks like the same. So it looks like Alive and Roman
the
numeral
capital,
three.
The capital I. They really should put the little feet at the top.
Yeah,
of the
or make it shorter or something.
Look
yeah.
exactly like the two lowercase L's.
Guys, I think I'm gonna throw up.
We'll blame Spotify.
I'm so devastated right now. I can't even look at you right now. I'm covering my eyes. Noah, can you conduct the rest of the interview?
Sure. So if all our listeners can email Spotify and say, you guys made us an embarrassment.
No. You made Kyle an embarrassment. Well, thank you for correcting that. I've been spreading false.
I am perpetually 3 years old. Yes.
Alive and three.
Alive and three. That is me.
Well, that ruins like most of my questions now.
they're all about the number three.
It's like, so tell me about, you're like, what is this guy talking about? Well, now I know.
Yes.
And I'm not a humming fool, but a humbled one.
Yeah, there you go.
So thank you, Micah.
No problem.
That's your next song, right? Humbled fool.
Kyle's an idiot. That's the next one. So you talked about having peace, and that's a good transition to one of my first questions. This is something that I find hilarious that continues just throughout all your journey is you and your mom's relationship. And you describe her as someone who is constantly trying to kill your rap dreams, thinks that you need a real job, and remains perpetually unimpressed with what you do. Whenever I see
facts.
Yes. Whenever I see that, it really makes me laugh. And you always, you know, say it kind of tongue in cheek, but I've always kind of wondered, I was like, how does that actually feel for you? Do you have peace with that? And like, what is that dynamic? Because I'm sure a lot of our listeners, and I know myself, can relate to people not understanding you as an artist, or not, maybe at the best they don't understand you, but at the worst they judge it. They don't take it seriously. So I was wondering if you could kind of touch, you seem to have made peace with it, but I was wondering just how you can speak to that.
Yeah, I mean, most days I'm cool with it. You know, sometimes it hurts. My mother would fall into the category of both not understanding it and judging it at times. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, like most kids want to make their parents proud. You know, most kids want their parents or any adult or like figure in their lives that they respect. They want them to be proud of what they're doing with their life and the choices they're making. And so obviously I want that for my mom and my dad. My mom, and this is, you know, it's probably true of a lot of people, not just folks who are pursuing art as a career, mm-hmm. but people who are nonconformists to a lot of cultural expectations for life. My mom is a lovely woman, but she is very, she makes a lot of decisions based on fear for her children. Mm. For herself, she's very courageous. She's not afraid of much. She's been through a lot and overcome a lot, but for her babies, you know, she wants them to have a easier time in life, a more comfortable life. That she doesn't want her children to struggle the way she struggled. She doesn't want them to face poverty or sickness or things like that. And so with my life and the choices I've made, I definitely do not make choices that lead to a comfortable life. It leads to struggle. It leads to danger at times. And also just, we didn't have a lot of money growing up. And so my mom has this idea in her head, like, I like being poor. And she just doesn't get it. Like, why would you choose, if now that I know that I am intelligent and creative and I can do things, why wouldn't I choose a career or a path that led to, you know, not necessarily ridiculous wealth, but comforts, you know? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I'm not up here trying to stay broke, but, you know, the stereotype starving artist comes from somewhere. It's really difficult to make a career as an artist, to make a living as an artist. But to me, I just don't care. Like, money is just, it's a necessary evil, and I don't care for it at all. And I'm not afraid of struggle, not only financially, but even with the content. Like, one of my mom's biggest problems recently with my most recent album, A Time Like This, it's not that she disagrees with a lot of the things I say. It's that she understands, very much so, being a Black woman who is a senior citizen and been around America a long time, she understands a lot of the things I'm talking about because she's lived through it. But she also understands how dangerous it is to confront those things. Mm-hmm. She also knows that people have gotten killed for this. People have gotten fired, blacklisted, and there's consequences to confronting injustices in a bold way. And I remember we were talking one time and she goes, "Why do you do this? You're putting a target on your back. Mm. When you talk about these things, you're putting yourself in danger. Why do you do this?" And so it's not just like, oh, you need a real job, although there's a part of that. It's like, she's like, yeah, you know, she can't recognize art as a legitimate, like, career choice. But also, she recognizes the danger that comes with being confrontational, whether it's through art or anything else. She recognizes how risky it is. And I respect that and I understand that, but I cannot cower to that. And I would rather put myself in harm's way to speak the truth. But yeah, then there's just the... I think the generational and cultural, like, difference in how we think. And, you know, for her, it's like, you know, find a spouse, get a good job, find a spouse, settle down, have some kids. Like, that's a good life. She's not, like, all money-driven, but it's just kind of like, you know, that's what it means to live. And I think she has these ideas in her head as to what a real job looks like. And so I remember one time I asked her, I said, okay, Mom, if I wasn't a poet and musician and instead I was a chef, right? Mm-hmm. And I was really good at cooking and I opened a restaurant and I had customers and that was my job. I started a restaurant and I went to the restaurant every day and cooked. Would that be a real job? She goes, yes. And I said, well, why? She goes, oh, well, because, you know, if you have a restaurant, then you have customers and, you know, people come in every day and eat and you get a steady paycheck. And I said, well, wait, no. Just because a restaurant is open doesn't mean that people eat there, mm-hmm. Or enough people eat there. It's not a steady paycheck because you might get, you know, five people come in all day, you know. And but in her mind, it's like it's a physical space. It's a building that you go to, you clock in, you have hours, you get a paycheck type thing.
Tangible.
So it's like tangible. But this idea of like making art and putting it out in the universe and waiting for emails to get invited to places, you know, yeah. It's like, you know, it's like, that's not real. Mm. And, you know, there's really, I've had so many conversations with her and there's just no way to, I mean, I don't want to say no way, but it doesn't seem like she's ever going to understand that concept. She's just, it just doesn't seem real to her and that's fine. But yeah, so my mom actually has not been very supportive of my art as a career. She recognizes my skill as a poet and musician. She's like, you make amazing art. I just don't want it to be your job. I don't want you to depend on it. And I don't want you to be in danger.
No.
Yeah. So she's not supportive. And it's really taken some time for me to process that and be like, that's okay. You know, like, I love her anyway. And she doesn't understand, and I know I need to keep doing this, and that's okay.
Yeah. Well, again, that's a good transition to my other question. You touched on your most recent album, A Time Like This. Is that the correct title? Did I read the title correctly? Or is it A Time Like Three?
A Time Like Three.
Anyway... it's a pointed critique of the racism, violence, sexism, and hypocrisy in American government, culture, and church. And you said I think it was Instagram, that when the album dropped, many people and institutions who supported you in the past abruptly, you know, just stopped. And you saw an immediate and significant nosedive and invitations to speak and perform, and that you just, your finances took a huge hit. Yeah. And so first off, it's starting as a, just a admiration for doing that. We talked recently, the name of the episode was a little bit different, but it was tackling dark subject matter. And we, in that, I expressed the fear of like, man, I'm scared to talk about these things because I don't know how people will react. Mm-hmm. And it's different to where, for me, I don't have, like you said, the target on me for mm-hmm. talking about these things. It's not going to result in physical or any kind of backlash like that. It's more just what people would think of me.
Just reception mm-hmm. of the
yeah,
the
it doesn't put a bullseye or anything on me. Mm-hmm. But so I, again, it varies for people, what they put out, the degree to which it will affect them. But I was wondering, just for you, in thinking about that, you know, when you were making that album, your thought process, did you struggle and toil with like, I'm afraid to do this? And then that made you go, no, well, that means I have to do it. I'm just curious because, like you said, it seemed like it was a rough experience in that way, but your voice hasn't changed at all. You continue to keep doing what you're doing. And last night, again, there's the critique. There's the same stuff. So,
yeah, no, I didn't flinch. I knew what I needed to say. Hmm. But after I said it, I was like, this is probably going to give me some heat.
Yeah.
And then when the heat came, I was like, this is hot.
Yeah.
So it was this weird thing. I don't regret saying it by any means, but I did, I think I did underestimate, how people would react. I knew that I was going to get some negative reactions. I knew that I was going to lose some support. I didn't realize how much. Mm-hmm. You know, I had been full-time as an artist for the past 6 years. And, you know, I wasn't balling out of control, but I was paying my bills.
Yeah.
And things were growing. You know, I was getting better. I was making more and more music and poetry and branching out. And after that album came back, it did. It was just like immediately things just plummeted. And I mean, without getting too specific, but like the year is almost up, you know, it's October and I've made about half as much money as I've made in the past 2-3 years. Mm-hmm. And my invitations have just like, I had a gig that had already booked me and they called and canceled. Mm-hmm. And they're like, we're not ready for the conversations you're having, the stuff you're putting out, you know? And at first, I was bummed because creatively speaking, I'm so proud of a time like this. Both the lyrical content and the production, shout out to my producer, Blaine Stark. The dude is a beast. I felt like it was unquestionably the best album I've ever done. It was my fourth full-length album, and it was my sixth project. I had two shorter EPs out, and I just felt so proud of it. And so to make what you consider your best art that you've ever made, and then to see the consequences of that cause your career to take a turn for the, I don't want to say turn for the worse, but financially speaking, it got more difficult.
Yeah.
Because career-wise, again, I feel like I'm very proud of what I made. But yeah, it was difficult. But I remember going to this conference in Philadelphia a few months after the album came out and stuff had started to go bad. And I was at this conference and it was called the Voices Conference and it was all about raising up leaders of color. And there were people in all different areas of life, the speakers, really diverse speakers. And you had college professors and people in business and people in all kinds of spaces, artists as well. And almost everybody who spoke was like, yeah, I was a professor at this institution and then I started confronting white supremacy and I got blacklisted and it eventually led to me losing my job. And someone else was like, I was in this and I started speaking out against this stuff and this sexism. And then it led to this and I lost my job or my position. And it was one of those things where I was like, oh wait, like this is supposed to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Like I'm in good company. Like this is what happens to people who are willing to confront these type of evils. Like you suffer because of it. It is a sacrifice. And so then it went from like, this isn't fair. Like I made a really good album and now nobody wants to book me to like, of course this was going to happen. Hmm. Like, you know, people die for this. You know, what right. did I expect? To confront white supremacy and a white supremacy nation be excited? Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, oh, thanks for the rebuke, brother.
You know what? You're right.
Matter of fact, let me take down this Confederate flag. Matter of fact, it is wrong to be sexist. Maybe I shouldn't grab women by the... You know what I'm saying? Like, like what did I expect, really? Yeah. You know, if I'm going to go there, then I need to be prepared for those consequences. And it's going to be tough, you know? And, but anyway, after leaving that weekend at that conference in Philly, I walked away very encouraged. And I was like, you know what? So after 6 years of being full-time, had to pick up a part-time job. And I'm proud of that because I'm like, it's a reminder that I was willing to sacrifice something significant to speak the truth. And I don't want to have to stay there, but if I do, so be it. You know, there's this passage in the Bible that I feel like is really like kind of like dang. But more or less, it basically says, if you're suffering, you know, for the truth, it says, you know, and you haven't suffered unto death yet. Basically, more or less, it's like, you're suffering, but have you suffered unto death? Like, and it sounds like really lacking compassion, but it is a reminder, like, you know, people actually die for this. Mm-hmm. So if you are fighting injustice, if you are boldly speaking the truth and you're suffering because of it, like, man, like, good job. Mm-hmm. Keep going.
You're doing something right.
You're doing something right. You're in good company. You're like, okay, like what you want? Like, you could, if you don't want to suffer, you cannot confront these things. You can see these things and just let them be, but you won't be able to sleep with yourself at night. Yeah. You know? Yeah. So yeah.
No, that's awesome. What was the name of the conference you said that you...
It was called the Voices Conference. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's really cool. I think it's really easy to just kind of... When one's making something, you get caught up in the individual. And so I imagine, like, yeah, that would really be really powerful to go to a place where you have all these people who are like, oh, yeah, like...
Yeah.
We were rebuked. We were fired. We were shamed. We were all these things. Yeah. And like, but... What road were we going to go down? We're always going to go down this road, and like to be affirmed in that mission of like, yeah, it might suck,
yeah,
but like, what else are we going to make? Like, this is the stuff we want to talk about. So
exactly, and at the end of the day, it's like that. Like, what else am I going to make in this context with this madness going on?
Mm-hmm.
I'm just going to make some really easily digestible stuff that's going to get me booked on some feel good tour.
Mm-hmm.
Like, heck no. Mm. Heck no, I'd rather die. Like, straight up, you know, like, heck no. Like, I wouldn't be able to sleep with myself. There's no way I can. And I know how to write popular stuff. I know how to write poems and songs to just get applause and make people feel good. But that is the last thing we need right now, you know? So.
Well, and I feel like that aligns itself really well with art in general and creativity, where you can be a creative and fail at what you're doing regardless of the your themes and all that stuff, and then see other people do the same. Or, you know, you go back in history and like Van Gogh never like sold one painting in his life.
Yeah.
And then he like was successful after his death, you know? And so like, again, you're in good company if you're a struggling artist. It doesn't mean that you're not doing the right thing.
Yeah.
So I feel like kind of social justice and art go really well together in that way.
Yeah, so while we're on it, can you kind of talk us through the creation of a time like this, just in formulating all the things you wanted to talk about, and then it going from thought to paper to recording? We recently again had another band here, and I told them, I was like, I'm very ignorant when it comes to music, like what goes into doing it and the process and how long it takes. And so I was wondering if you could just talk about that for a little bit.
Yeah, a time like this was unique for me. It was a very different process than my other three albums. My other three albums were more of just like, I'm living, I'm writing, I'm creating, having experiences and creating from those. And then after, you know, a year and a half, 2 years, you kind of gather all the stuff you've written in that season and you look for themes and you pick certain pieces out and you do an album. And that's kind of how it had gone. For the three previous albums. But with a time like this, with the exception of the poems, so it's 12 rap songs and 4 poems, but pretty much all of the songs I wrote like within a 6-7 month period. I felt a very strong conviction that I had something to say specifically to this context. And so it all spilled out much faster than my other albums. It was directly in response to Trump winning the election in fall 2016. And then basically I started writing the album. That's when I started thinking about it and just feeling so frustrated. I put out a song, which actually was on the tail end of my blues album coming out. So I was still kind of in the bluesy mode. So I put out a song called No Bowing Down. And that was like kind of the really seed of what later grew into A Time Like This. But I was like, I knew that through my art, I wanted to resist. And so No Bowing Down was a blues album or a blues single, because I was kind of still in my bluesy mode. And it was a resistance song, very much so. And it's just like, hey, you know, we done walked through the fire before. Won't be no bowing down. And it was just like, look, black folks have been through a lot. And it looks like we're going to have a rough 4 years, but we will not bow to this like we have never bowed to any injustice in the past. We've persevered. We've hoped in the darkest of times. And so I put that out. But then, so he wins the election in the fall. Fast forward to the top of the year, and it was after his inauguration. And I'm just like, yeah, said no. Like, that single was not enough. I was like, oh my God, I got more to say. I'm just like, I cannot believe this. I'm so upset. But I can believe it at the same time. I'm not surprised at all. I've been saying this stuff. Black folks been saying this stuff. Mm. And so it was just bubbling up inside of me. And I just started writing like a madman. Like I just wrote very quickly. And I had very specific things that I knew I wanted to address. I'm like, all right, I'm going to address sexism. I'm going to address militarism. Just War Theory was one of the... I think it was the only poem that I actually wrote in that new season. The other three had already written, but I was like, I'm going to come at the way we think about the military. I'm going to come at this and this and this and this. And I did. And I just sat down and I just kind of disciplined myself to crank it out, because I really wanted it to be out in 2017 as a direct response to, you know, him being inaugurated in 2017. And the album was done, but it just... It was money that, you know, that kind of slowed us down. So we ended up doing a Kickstarter and stuff. But yeah, that process, it was more like this. It all flooded out in a very short period of time versus just kind of letting songs come to me over a couple of years. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Well, I think with that, I say we give the people a little bit of a taste that album. And This weekend, I got to hear you perform Freak Show a couple times, but I'll never tire of it because it's freaking delicious. And so listeners, have a taste of Freak Show, and then we'll be right back.
Some drunk poet was singing of God and his mercies, quietly sipping his gin, painting a picture of words from a portrait of Jesus becoming again. And all sing, oh Lord, oh grace. And all sing, oh Lord, oh grace.
Never dismiss the visions of madmen. Wisdom can be gathered from anyone who sees what others cannot. Drunk men tell no tales. Poets cannot lie. Poets cannot lie because we do not divide fact from fiction. There's often more truth in our fantasy worlds and metaphors than human courts where liars swear to speak honestly in the name of laws they break, in the name of gods they disobey. The prayers of the proud will never reach heaven. But God hears the slurred words of the stumbling prophets, and all will be cursed who mock them. It is not an easy task to plead with the world, to grieve for the world, especially since God often speaks through those most broken. The picture we paint in our minds is a far cry from the reality of heaven. When the saints go marching in, it will not be a parade of the almost perfect. God does not reserve grace for those who only need a little bit. The healthy are in no need of a doctor. The healer is for the sick. Heaven will be a freak show. Promiscuous young men will embrace the virgin priests who molested them, and their hearts will both be pure. How amazing is grace! The street corner preacher will be greeted by thousands of people she thought were not listening. Thank you for enduring the times we mocked you. Your sidewalk sermons are why we know God. How amazing is grace! Aborted children will tug the spotless robes of young women and say, "Hello, mother. I'm so glad to finally meet you." The former master will see the lashed back of his no longer slave and say, "You taught me the love of the Savior." The suicide bomber who prayed for forgiveness during the millisecond between pressing the detonator and standing before the throne of God. The guilty thief hanging next to Jesus on the cross. The madman who spoke to invisible beings will stand between Michael and Gabriel with a grin as wide as an angel's wingspan and say, "I knew I wasn't crazy." The missus and the mistress, the victim and the rapist, the foreign and the racist, the bullies and the geeks. All those who somewhere along the way believed, whose sins were forgiven and strength was given to love their enemies. So many we swore there is no way in hell we would see them in heaven. But they will be there. We will be there. With a song on our lips and our eyes full of faith. And we'll sing, "How amazing is grace."
Some drunk poet was singing of God and his mercies, quietly sipping his gin, painting a picture of words from a portrait of Jesus becoming again. Oh, sing, oh Lord, oh grace. Oh, sing, oh Lord, oh grace. Oh, sing, oh Lord, oh grace. Oh, sing, oh Lord.
All right, welcome back, everybody. Thanks for taking a second to listen to that track. Again, I got to hear a little bit about it this weekend, the story behind that song, but I was wondering for our listeners if you could kind of paint that same picture that you painted for us, because I think it speaks to kind of what you're talking about of some of these things make people uncomfortable or aren't ideas or concepts that have been addressed before. And that's what I love about the album. And so if you could just talk about Freak Show specifically.
Yeah, I'll give you a little extra inside scoop too. So Freak Show, when I perform it live, I just kind of perform it, just the poem part. But if you listen to the way it's on the album, it's actually accompanied by a folk song. And that song by itself is actually called Drunk Poet. Mm. And I was at an open mic in Denver. And this couple got up. Their names are Kevin and Anya Looper. And they, I was going to be featuring some and sharing some poetry. But there's open mic before. And they sang this song. And the first line of it just captured me. Like the world stopped. And I'm just locked in. And they get up there and harmonizing beautifully and just say, some drunk poet was singing of God and his mercy, quietly sipping his gin. And that was it for me. I'm zoned in. And I'm like, because when I heard that line, I just got this image of in my head of this grungy looking homeless person, that type of person that you have all kind of negative stereotypes about, smelling like alcohol, right? Mm-hmm. Walking down the street, stumbling over themselves, literally drinking gin, singing Amazing Grace. Singing a hymn of praise, a hymn of gratitude, of thanksgiving to God, while drunk, stumbling down the street, right? Some drunk poet was singing of God and his mercy. And that, to me, I was like, that's it. That's it. And I did not know these people at all. And I went up to him and I said, your song is beautiful. I know I don't know you, but if you would be open to collaborating one day, I would love to pair that song with some poetry. You mentioned the person in your song is a poet, and I'm a poet. And it just really resonates with me because I feel like that. I feel like this stumbling poet who is really messed up, still trying to sing of the mercy of God and the grace of God and the beauty of God. I really resonate with your song. So if you're open to it, I'd love to collaborate one day. And they said, oh, sure. You know, like we kind of just do this casually. And so I said, well, if you have a rough recording of it, you can send it to me. That'd be great. And I'll try to write something that goes with it. So they did. And they sent me a rough recording of their song. And I didn't do anything with it for like 2 years. It just wasn't ready yet. I didn't have it yet. Anyway, fast forward, Freak Show, the poem part of it. I wrote that. So obviously it was inspired partially by that song and then partially by a poem by a guy named Anis Mojgani. And Anis Mojgani is an incredible spoken word poet, and he has this poem called Shake the Dust. And Shake the Dust is a poem that is dedicated to anyone who, for any reason, might feel like a social outcast. So in the beginning of the poem, it's a really feel-good poem because it's like, you know, this one is for the kid who wears glasses and gets called Four Eyes. This one's for the handicapped girl in the wheelchair. You know, shake the dust, shake the dust. And you're listening to it and you're like, yeah, awesome. Stand up for the little person. And it's just like, don't listen to the bullies and just shake the dust. Keep going. You know, you're important. You're beautiful. Shake the dust. And it's a really easy poem to like until he gets to the middle of it. And in the middle of the poem, he has this line and he says, to the celibate pedophile who keeps on struggling, shake the dust. And that that line of poetry just, it stopped me dead in my tracks. I froze. Because I go to a lot of open mics and I hear a lot of poets share their experience with being molested as children, being raped as children. And I hear a lot from the perspective of the victim, which is good and necessary. We should hear those stories. Mm-hmm. We should allow people to share and process and heal. But I had never heard anyone address that issue with the perpetrator in mind and what that must be like. And so it was the first time I thought to myself, what would it be like for a moment to just put yourself in the shoes of an adult who is plagued with experiencing sexual attraction towards children? If this is your reality, whether you've acted on it in the past or not, but currently this is your reality and you're trying your best to remain celibate, every time you hear someone like you brought up in casual conversation with friends, in TV, on the news, in a movie, in a book, an article, anytime you hear someone like you brought up, the only thing you hear is ill, gross, disgusting, menace to society, lock them up. I hope they die and burn in hell. It'd be better if they never existed. What kind of monster, what kind of animals could do something like that to children, could even think of doing something like that to children? What type of grotesque, inhumane beast would want to touch a child like that? That's all you hear. And then you hear this poet come on stage. And in one line of poetry, I thought it was so brilliant how Anis took a firm, uncompromising stance on the justice of the issue. He said, to the celibate pedophile, if this is your reality, I need you, I expect you to be celibate, to remain celibate for the good of all society. But in the same breath of taking that stance, he still extended so much grace to the celibate pedophile who keeps on struggling. Shake the dust. You know, I think about when we confront evil and injustice, it feels good to oversimplify it and make it black and white. Good mm-hmm. guys, bad guys. Evil people, righteous people. But fact of the matter is, if you felt those type of attractions to children, what would be more motivating? Hearing somebody say that you're disgusting and inhumane and grotesque, or hearing someone gently encourage you to pursue what is good and acknowledge your struggle and your humanity to the celibate pedophile who keeps on struggling. I cannot imagine how difficult that must be. Thank you for fighting. Keep fighting. Keep struggling. We appreciate you. Look at yourself in the mirror and say you're not disgusting. It wouldn't be better if you were never born. You shouldn't just rot in a jail cell or die and go to hell. You know, which would be more motivating? Hearing that type of encouragement and that challenge, or hearing someone just throw you away and say mm-hmm. you piece of nothing, not worth anything human. You know, so when I heard that, I was challenged by it because it's a difficult idea. Mm-hmm. But as a person of faith, specifically as a person of Christian faith, the more I grow in my own personal faith, the more I come to understand that what it means to be like Jesus is to love your enemies, is to love people into a conviction to pursue what is right and good. And again, like just telling people they're terrible people, even if they are, is not necessarily going to motivate them to change. Mm-hmm. Telling people that they are loved and that they can change and that there is hope, and calling them to live a life that is beautiful and right and good, I think that's what we're called to do if you call yourself a follower of Jesus. And even if you don't, and you just believe in approaching things in a way that might actually have a chance of working. Mm-hmm. You know, even if you're not religious, I guarantee you this approach will be more effective than self-righteously just insulting people that you disagree with or that are evil, like objectively are doing bad things. Just mm-hmm. like, you know, you got loving people, even terrible people will change them before just condemning them and hating them.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I feel like to go with your point, when you focus on someone's demons, whatever they are, and you chastise them for those demons, I feel like they're even more likely to do the thing that society is telling them, oh, well, this is what you do. You're trash because of it. They're like, well, yes, then I am trash and that's what I'm going to be doing.
Yeah.
You know, and again, yeah, to go with your point, if you do the opposite of that and say, hey, focus on the part that makes you good. and keep fighting. Again, thank you for fighting. I think that's a lot more effective.
Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah. And I just love it because it is challenging. Mm-hmm. The first time I heard Freak Show, I didn't have that context and, didn't know about that. And so the song itself was challenging because it's thinking about like me, I was confronted with my own judgment of just like who I imagine will be in heaven. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, like I'm going to be so wrong. Like, even though I'm learning this lesson, I'm going to be so wrong. Even when I get there, it's going to be like, oh, and then hearing that, like when you talked about it on Friday, again, it's kind of like whenever you say that, it's like you say pedophile, it's like, ugh, you get that shiver. And then when you went into that story, I was like, I felt shame because I was like, I can't imagine what that would feel like. And I admit my brain's like, I don't want to. Like, mm-hmm. I can leave. It's like, but there's people who can't. They have to stay in that reality. Mm-hmm. And so, I know people have tons of different thoughts, and even maybe are people listening are uncomfortable or like, why are you guys talking about this? But I this is the stuff I love. Mm-hmm. And I think like you're allowed to have your own opinion, but don't make uncomfortable synonymous with wrong. And so I love that.
And I don't like it.
Yeah.
I wrote it. It makes me uncomfortable.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? I wrote Freak Show. I didn't write the other part. That was a niece. Mm-hmm. But he challenged me. But yeah, it's this is the thing. I performed that poem one time, and there is a woman who came up to me, and she said she was a child trauma counselor, right? And so she's like, I was always working with kids and counseling kids after they had been molested, after they had been raped, and trying to put the pieces back together and trying to help them heal. And she's talking about young kids here. Mm-hmm. And she goes, when I would hear their stories, I realized this is not like, freaks in a van with no windows, like rolling up next to an elementary school and snatching a random child and molesting them and throwing them back out on the street. She goes, so many of their stories, their abusers were upstanding members of their community. Mm-hmm. They were family people who had spouses and good jobs and no history of molesting children. Mm-hmm. And she goes, I realized I felt like I was coming in too late. She's like, after working with the children for so long, I thought to myself, who's talking to these adults? Who's counseling them before they do it and helping them? Nobody. Why? Because we created a culture that is so condemning of even the idea of someone like that, that they're too afraid to say anything to anyone. Again, who can you talk to and feel safe, right? The consequences of that, if you're in a relationship and you have a partner, you're supposed to be able to confide in your partner. But if you confess to your partner, hey, sometimes I feel sexual attraction towards 5-year-olds, will that person support you? Or will they be like, I'm out.
Yeah.
I want a divorce. Or if you're a religious person, part of a religious community, and you go to your priest or your pastor or, whoever the person may be, and you say, hey, this is something I'm struggling with. Are they going to allow you to remain a part of that community and to continue to be involved? Will they say, oh no, you can't be a part of this anymore? Or, if you tell your family, if you have nephews and nieces, suddenly are you never allowed to see your family again? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It
would change everything.
It would change everything. And and that's the thing. It's like, look, like we have to create somewhere, even if it's just you and the people in your life, like to let folks know, like, hey, I want to hear all of your struggles, and I will not judge you for any of them. Like, obviously you want to protect your community, you want to protect children, but also by being so condemning of these type of adults, you're not protecting children because you're encouraging those adults to keep those things secret and
internalized,
and they are not getting any help, and they're not getting any support, and they're not getting any counsel because they're too afraid, and that actually harms our children. So it's actually counterproductive to what the end goal is to stop these things, So Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like often the community that rejects a person for going through these things, it was the one thing keeping them from doing that thing.
Right?
Yeah,
right.
And so then they have no support system at all. And so they're like, again, like, oh, well, I guess this is who I am.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's tough.
Well, that's why I think the taboo is so destructive, the fact that it's labeled taboo. It's because, yeah, we keep so many things hidden in the dark in our culture. We say we don't talk about this. We don't even whisper any hint of it. You know, he who shall not be named, you know, that sort of mentality. And yeah, you have people who struggle with these things, and it must be so lonely. And it's like, you know, there's a varying degree to, you know, physically disobeying the law and what's in your own heart. But we're all capable of doing terrible things, and we all have bad desires, you know, again, of varying degrees. But I know some people roll their eyes at the romantic notion of art, which will be a good transition to one of my questions for you. But it really is. It's like that's the kind of stuff that I want to make is shining a light on that stuff. And again, it makes me scared because like, I'm scared of what people will say or think of me, or like, shut up, don't talk about that. But it's really like, well, the other way's not working.
Yeah.
Your way's not doing anything. Mm-hmm. So maybe if we can confront this stuff, where we give a voice to these people, or we say, I disagree with what you're doing, but you're not alone and I'm willing to sit here with you. I think that's powerful. So, taking it away from me and going to you, the idea of, the power of art just being this romantic notion and not actually really accomplishing anything, that's a big thing for you. And again, I apologize because you've talked about this multiple times throughout the weekend. So but your motto for, and I don't, was it before a time like this that you had fight evil with poetry?
No, I can give you the whole story on.
All right, tell me a tale, Micah.
Yeah, so when I was promoting a time like this, so we were working on the album, it wasn't out yet, but we were looking to promote it. So I just went through, listened to it, and I pulled phrases out of different songs and poems. And we, me and my graphic designer, Chris Campbell, he just put together what originally were just like Instagrammable little graphics that had different chunks of lyrics from the songs and poems. And so Fight Evil with Poetry is just a lyric from A Time Like This from the track Just War Theory. Mm. But it was one of, I think we made six different graphics. And like another one was, Love is a Hill Worth Dying On. These are just things I say on the album. And so we threw these graphics up on on Instagram and Facebook to promote the album. And we just got a whole lot of strong response specifically to Fight Evil with Poetry. And so I was like, oh, people really like this. And so that gave me the idea. And again, at the time, I was just thinking about promoting A Time Like This. So once the album came out, I remembered how much people liked that phrase and that graphic, Fight Evil with Poetry. So I made T-shirts, posters, stickers, just merch to promote the album primarily. So that's what I ended up doing. And then I started wearing the T-shirt and the hoodie out in public and when I would travel for shows. And I noticed something. I noticed that the reactions I would get to it were so strong. And it was not just, oh, cool shirt, or I like your shirt. It opened doors to conversations with complete strangers, deep conversations about the most private things in their life. Like, I remember I got on a plane. This happened on two different occasions. I get on a plane and I sit down, and the person sitting next to me sees my shirt, says Fight Evil with Poetry. And the woman goes, oh, you write poetry? And I'm like, yeah. And she goes, I used to write poetry. And she starts talking about her poetry. And the next thing you know, she is telling me her whole life story. She's opening up. And it was just like magic. And it was the same thing happened with another person, and random people on the street would stop me and start talking to me about poetry and creativity and this shirt. And they were so vulnerable. And what I realized was, for whatever reason, this phrase, Fight Evil with Poetry, across my chest, just, it made people feel safe. Hmm. It made me realize that people from all different backgrounds and faiths and philosophies and worldviews, when they hear the word poet, when they see someone walking with a shirt that identifies that person as a poet, the assumption is that is a safe person. That is a good person. That is a loving person. That is a person I can confide in. And that was an eye-opener for me. And I realized there's something powerful here. There's something more than just, oh, it's a lyric from my album. Go listen to my album. You know? And I just felt compelled that, like, man, this can't stop here. It can't stop with promoting my album, and it can't stop with just poetry, because for me, Fight Evil with Poetry was never meant to just be about poets or people who write poetry, but it's about anybody who believes in combating injustice with creativity, any form of creativity. So from that, I kept talking to the guy who designed the thing, and we got the idea of doing an anthology, which we're working on now, and it's called the Fight Evil with Poetry Anthology. We contacted like 30 poets and asked them to send me two or three poems about different issues of justice. And so me and Chris are putting it all together in a book, and we're going to sell it, and the proceeds from the online sales are going to go to nonprofits. So in a very tangible way, we're like selling these poems and taking the money and giving it to people who are doing good things in the world. But so that's like the cool part. But back to what you were asking, the kind of the struggle with it is the best way to go into this is I was wearing the shirt one day, and this woman saw my shirt, and she got really excited, and she goes, oh, I love your shirt. I wish it worked. And it was like, I was so excited for a second, and then it was just a crash, right? And I'm like, okay, I get it. You know, Fight Evil with Poetry, in her mind, it was cute. It was a nice t-shirt, but I mean, come on, let's be realistic here. What is poetry going to do in the face of evil, in the face of lynching, in the face of Hitler? You know, you're going to throw a poem at Hitler's head and expect it to do something. Mm-hmm. That was the sentiment. Like, that's a nice idea, but it doesn't actually work. But the thing is, I disagree. Again, from back what we were talking about before, the way Anis approached that topic of pedophilia in his poem, I think that could actually motivate someone to keep fighting. Mm-hmm. It could motivate someone to stop abusing, right? And in the same way, when I look specifically in Black American history, if we're talking about racial injustice and evil in the American context, you know, the civil rights movement that was most popularized as led by King was not the only movement of the day. There were other movements that came out of the Black community that were not committed to nonviolence, that had a different philosophy. They did not say fight evil with poetry. They believed that they had a right to defend themselves by any means necessary. They wasn't attacking white people, but they say, hey, if white folks try to lynch us, we will shoot them. Mm-hmm. Right? And that is a very understandable thing to believe and to promote, and most humans feel that way. Mm-hmm. White Americans felt that way. In the beginning of America, Patrick Henry stands up and says, give me liberty or give me death. He was basically saying, we will fight for our freedom. Mm-hmm. We felt oppressed and we have a right. And you started a war, a revolutionary war, and you killed because you felt like you were being oppressed. That makes sense to me on a human level. But a lot of people die when you fight evil with bullets and violence, even if you are justified, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. But the crazy thing about it to me is in Black American history, although there were other movements and other organizations, you know, like the Black Panthers, who accomplished a lot of good, and other expressions of resistance to white supremacy and hate that accomplished a lot of good. But the most effective expression of the civil rights movement in America was the expression of it that fought evil with poetry, led by King and other leaders in the Black church. It was really put together by what was called the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which was a bunch of Black Christians who were committed to resisting evil in a nonviolent, creative way. How did they resist lynching and police brutality and segregation? They walked down the street arm in arm with anybody of any color who was willing to walk with them. They walked down the street singing gospel songs, singing "We Shall Overcome," singing "Eyes on the Prize, Hold On," right? They literally were facing like crazy violence and hate, and they countered it with songs, with peaceful protests, with sitting at segregated lunch counters, just ordering bacon and eggs, right? It was like they fought evil with poetry, and it actually worked. It actually worked. And that's what I would say to that woman if I was not so frustrated in the moment. I just had to, I had to swallow my tongue because I was like, oh, Lord, help me, because I'm about to go off on this lady. But yeah, that's the thing. It's like it actually works. And it not only worked in the American context, it worked in the Indian context. You know, Gandhi was also committed to nonviolence and led a revolution which worked. Mm. India gained its freedom from the British Empire through nonviolent protests. They fought evil with poetry, and it worked. You know, fighting fire with fire may be justified, but it does not. If you gain your freedom through violence, then you have to keep it through violence or the threat of violence. Mm. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like, you overthrow an oppressor violently, then you better make sure you have the guns to defend yourself and keep yourself in that position. And as soon as the people who got overthrown can rebuild and get strong enough to come at you, they're going to come at you. Yeah. But if you gain your freedom through nonviolent protests, through creativity, then it's likely that by the time you get freedom, you have also changed the culture. You have changed hearts. And that's a more long-lasting change, you know? So.
Fantastic. I'm so excited you're here. This is so good.
Yeah. And also a lot of what you're saying too is I was thinking when we were at the show over the weekend, I was like, man, I wish more people were here because this is so important. And I didn't want to just make you repeat yourself if you wanted it to be organic and stuff. But I'm so glad that you're able to still communicate that because it's so good.
Mm-hmm. So you talked about how you're going to be having Fight Evil with Poetry as an anthology piece that you're currently working on. I saw somewhere that you wrote that for every album or project that you produce, there's like 10 that get pushed to the wayside. So besides that anthology, what else are you wanting to do? What else is on the horizon? And when can we expect it? Because I want it now, which is the most annoying thing to hear. I think no one said it. But like, put out a baby and someone's like, when's the next dates. One?
Yeah. Ain't no dates. I'm working. This is the thing, man. I'm constantly creating. I never feel like I'm creating enough, but realistically, I'd be cranking stuff out, yo. Mm-hmm. I'd been a full-time artist for 5 years and I had 6 projects released. So, you know, 4 full-length albums, 2 EPs, and a bunch of other video projects and stuff here and there. But right now I'm working on several things. I'm working on several things and I don't know when any of them will be out. The soonest one will be the anthology that me and Chris Campbell edited. So that'll be out within the next few months for sure. After that, I'm working on my first book of poetry.
Yes.
Writing for the page is very different than spoken word performance. So it's taking some adjustments. So I don't know when it's going to be out. It definitely won't be out anytime soon, though. But I'm working on it diligently. So I'm working on a book of poetry. And I'm always writing music. Mm. I'm doing a lot of collaboration with one of my homegirls, actually, who was featured on my last album, A Time Like This, the song Kissed. And she was also on what you call it? All Hands on Deck. Her name is Lucy. Mm. She's super dope singer, artist, a great writer herself as well. And so we've been working on a lot of songs together that are kind of fall in kind of like the folky It's folky vibe, but it's not like straight up folk music. It's also going to have, she's Dominican, Afro-Latina, so it's going to have a bit of like kind of African diaspora influence in the sound and Caribbean drum type stuff. So anyway, so I'm working on some music with her. We don't know when that will be out either, but those are the biggest three things for me would be the anthology, in my book, and then the music with Lucy is going to be the next few projects. And then after those things, I do want to do a follow-up to a time like this, in the sense of not necessarily a part two to the album, but just another hip-hop album. Because that was, even though I was rapping before I did poetry, A Time Like This was my first full-length rap album, which was pretty crazy because I'd been doing it for so long. But I think it just, that one took longer than the spoken word albums and the blues album, I think, because I was more particular about it, because hip hop was my first love and I wanted it to be really good, you know. So I put a lot of pressure on myself for my first rap album. So yeah.
Oh, dude, that's so exciting. I didn't know about any of those. Yeah. So pat on my back for asking, but also slap to my face, because now I have to like wait. It's going to be a struggle. But and you're much. You've been in the game so long and much more than I have at all. I'm a wee babe. I don't say that to put myself down, whatever. But it is true, like written poetry as opposed to spoken word slash performing it is such a different experience. And I learned that the hard way.
Yeah.
When I first read aloud, I was like, I got up there. It was a whole bad experience. I had cut my thumb beforehand. So I had this giant bandage. I had just gotten new glasses, new prescription. So I'm up there with tiny like pages. I printed it, but the text was tiny. I can't turn the page, never performed before. And I just was like, oh, this was a terrible idea. Why I do this? Because I had written them just to be read. And so it didn't translate well. So I imagine kind of the opposite, going from doing that most of the time to then writing would be a little bit of an adjustment.
Yeah, definitely. You can't like, I mean, you can, but I don't think it's the best way to approach a book of poetry. If you're a spoken word poet and you've done mostly spoken word, you don't want to just print your poems in a book. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, some people who like might be super fans and just want to study your work might appreciate it, but it's a different approach. Like they're connected, but they're not the same thing. And so you really want to respect the difference in this particular expression of poetry, because with spoken word, your words are only part of it, you know, but you speak with your whole body, with your facial expressions, with what you do with the rest of your body, with your volume and everything. Whereas when you're doing a book of poetry, you know, all people have are the words on the page. It's limiting in some ways, but it's also, it also creates other things that you don't have in spoken word. So it's not so much that I feel limited. I just have to make the appropriate adjustments. So, for example, with spoken word poetry, I never think about how the words look on a page because people aren't reading it. Mm-hmm. So a lot of my spoken word poems, if you look at them, they just look like essays. They're just paragraphs. But when you're doing a book of poetry, you have to think about the length of the lines, the breaks, how many lines are in a stanza. You know, you can be creative with, now there's a whole visual element to the words. How do the words look when printed? Right. And there's things that you can do. I've been reading a lot more page poets in preparation for my own book and trying to learn. And there's one poem that I read that had this metaphor of water and rivers in it. And on the page, they printed the poem in such a way that it was subtle, but literally a river ran through the middle of the poem. They just spaced it out in the middle of the lines, you know? And so you're like reading about this water and this river, and then you notice like, oh, there's a river down here. So it's things like that, that you can't do that with spoken word, right? So, but then also there's a lot more, I don't have to always use words in spoken word. I can just show things with my body, you know? Where you can't show things with your body in page poetry. But also it tends to be more condensed and concentrated, because a spoken word poem often will run song length, like 3 to 5 minutes. But usually if you're reading a book of poetry, you can flip through and read through a poem in a minute or two at most, you know? And so it's like I found like using fewer words is different. Thinking about how the poem looks on the page is different. There's just so many adjustments to be made. So it's definitely a challenge for me and growing me as a poet and as a writer. So I love it, but it's taking some work. But it's also causing me to generate a lot of new content. Because at first, I was trying to take some of my spoken word poems and edit them in a way so that they work on the page. And I did that with a few of them, but I very quickly realized, no, a lot of these poems, I just want them to remain as spoken word poems and be performance-based. And I'm going to write new stuff. And I'm going to, the new stuff is going to be written with the book in mind. And it's been a good challenge. Yeah.
Dang it, Kyle. Why did I leave it not on silent? Well, and it's Lauren. Lauren, shout out to Lauren. That's my sister. Anyway, no, that's awesome. And so you said you've been reading a lot, and that's something that I noticed, again, doing that deep dive, and just from having followed you on Instagram and Facebook and all that stuff for a long time, I think you and I both seem to struggle with the same problem, which is buying too many books. And so absolutely. Is that and maybe not just poetry, but anything, is that kind of the medium that inspires you the most? Maybe it's, I mean, music as well, but like, what is it about books that makes you just not be able to stop buying them and keep reading?
Yeah, you know, I don't really get inspired by other art as much. I appreciate other art, but I don't get inspired by it. I'm like, that was dope. And it makes me glad that I'm also a creative and an artist and a poet. But it's most of my inspiration comes from two places. The first one is just life. You know, just having experiences, meeting people, having conversations. But the other one is, I won't say just reading as much as learning. So I realized if I find myself in a dry spell where I really feel like it's difficult for me to write and I haven't really been liking the stuff I'm writing, it's usually because I'm not reading. Because for me, reading and learning, it acts like ingredients. Like I'm just pouring ingredients into my mind. So in college, even though I was busy, I had two part-time jobs, full-time student, all this stuff, I was writing more than ever. Why? Because every single day I'm going to classes and I'm being challenged by these doctors, professors on philosophy, on theology, on whatever I'm learning. And it's just like even things that are not directly related to creativity and a lot of things that people might not consider creative at all. It was just like, I'm being challenged on my worldview. I'm being challenged on you know, how to think and all this stuff. And even though I hated the structure of school and the deadlines of homework and all these things that were difficult for me, I always loved learning, always loved being challenged. And so, yeah, for me, part of the reason I read a lot is because when I read more, I write more. And I just have more. If my mind is chewing on something, trying to digest and process something, out of that process comes creativity for me. You know, if I'm not challenging myself, then my brain just isn't working, you know, but I don't read. I just started reading a lot more poetry, but most of the stuff I read a lot of nonfiction. I read a lot of philosophy. I read a lot of theology. I read a lot of like sociology and, like stuff about Black history and American culture from more like of an analysis, like the new Jim Crow that's talking about the criminal justice system in America. Like I read books like that, you know? And so I don't read a lot of creative things. I almost never read novels. And I'm not saying this is like a good thing that I'm proud of. It's just, these are just my habits.
Sure.
You know, I want to challenge myself to read more novels and short stories. And I started reading more poetry, to be honest, only because I wanted to write a book of poetry. And I was like, I should probably see what other people do. And I'm glad I started reading more books of poetry because I am getting inspired and realizing the possibilities for the page that I wasn't as familiar with. But yeah, that's why I read a lot, because I love learning. And now that I'm not in school, I love reading even more because I can read at my own pace.
Yeah.
And I can choose what I read, not just read what's assigned to me on the syllabus. So now it feels like I can learn in a way that is good for me, at a pace that works for me. So
no, we just talked about that. We had an episode on education versus experience, and that was the downside of schools. That it can be really beneficial, but sometimes it's like I have to read these things, and then it's crunch time, as opposed to like, oh, I'm interested in this, I'm going to pursue these. So no, that's really cool. I hadn't heard someone say that they were inspired by necessarily what they're reading, that appreciating it, but being like, that doesn't necessarily feed into my own thing. So I think it's interesting to my brain. I'm going to chew on that for a while.
Yeah. I mean, it's just very rare that I like go home from a live show of a band, or I go home from an open mic or seeing a poet and write a poem. But it's very common that I like close a book and be like, I got to write something. You know, it's like, it's very
just gives you that energy. And,
because I'm just like, oh, dang. Like, that got me thinking, you know, whereas when I walk away from a dope performance, I'm just like, that was dope. Y'all want to go get some food? I mean, it definitely gets me thinking too, but it's just not, I don't know, for whatever reason, for me personally, I seldom get inspired by other art. Although it does happen, like I said, with Anissa's poem. But it's just few and far between. It's mostly like a conversation I have with somebody, an experience I had, or a book I was reading. Yeah.
I feel like that sort of kind of guarantees a unique approach to things, because you're kind of safe from copying other people.
Yeah, in that sense too, right? Like you want to, it's good and it's okay to be influenced by other people, but sometimes you can, you know, that those lines get blurred between am I inspired by them or am I ripping them off, you know?
Yeah.
No, that's interesting. And again, like that was, that's why I'm just thankful for this show, because that's just an assumption I would have had about all artists.
Yeah.
Which sounds dumb now, being on the flip side, where it's like, well, that's not the case, Kyle. But no, it's really interesting. Micah, our time is coming to a close. So I got one non-art related question, and then we'll get to our rapid fire and we'll get you out of here.
All right.
So
I'm going to eat some Slim Chickens.
Oh, I know. I heard that and I was like, I'm going to have to do that too.
I'm so excited. We don't have those in California. I was like, what? I don't know nothing about it. I just saw the logo. I love the name. I love the cleverness of it. And the little logo was dope. The chicken with the hat low. It looks pretty cool. I'm about to eat you, bro.
Okay. Well, you have to let me know, because again, I know that you're a fan of Church's chicken. So you have to tell me how tell me how it compares, because there's lots of debate around here, so we'll get your opinion on that later. But I talk about this a lot, Micah, probably too much. But I am a single man. This podcast is a desperate attempt to find a lady out there for me. But I have always, every year when it comes around, I love when you talk about anti-Valentine's Day open mic. And so I've never been able to attend for obvious reasons, but. Could you just walk me through what those nights entail? And
They're awesome. They're my favorite show of the year, every year. It was originally an attempt to do something fun on Valentine's Day for, you know, a lot of folks in a very real way. They get down on themselves around Valentine's Day and other holidays when you're supposed to be booed up and, you know, have your special someone and you don't. And, you know, when I was younger, I never thought I would be 30 and not married, you know, like, and I always just thought like I was going to get married young and, you know, and a lot of my expectations for that just, they didn't work out, you know, a lot of broken hearts and whatever. But again, life isn't what I thought it would be, and it's beautiful and I love it. And so it was just a silly thing to encourage people who were feeling lonely around Valentine's Day. And so I decided to host an open mic at my house, and it was anti-Valentine's Day open mic, where basically I invited everyone over and you could read all your angry, bitter love poems about all your past relationships that did not work out. And it was hilarious. It was sad. And then we had like a featured artist sing sad love songs, and it was wonderful. Like people, it was so funny. Like people just had so much fun. And another way just to like kind of, you know, show how much we were upset at everyone who was in love. Basically the show was free for single people, but if you were in a relationship, you actually had to pay $5.
Yes.
So it was a truly anti-Valentine's Day open mic. So we just did it a couple years back and it went so well that we decided to do it every year. And now I'm definitely going to do it every year until the day I die. Even if I'm married, you know, I'll put $5. $5 in the hat, whatever. But it's just fun and a place where people can process some of their pain. Can laugh at some of their pain and then realize like, hey, you know what? Like it's okay to not have someone. Actually, there's a whole lot of people who aren't in relationships and who aren't just sitting around waiting for one. They're living their lives. They're doing things. They're living, and it's beautiful, and everything comes with sacrifice, and everything, there's some difficult parts about it and some beautiful parts about it, you know? And I'm like, I kind of see it now. Like, it's like, I don't know, when I was younger, it was like all roads lead to marriage. Like my whole life, everything I was doing was like, well, until I get married, and once I get married, and then when I get married, and I would like orient all of my decision-making around that, like even to careers and opportunities and where I want to live. It's like, well, is this choice I'm making conducive to finding a partner? And it was just like, wait a minute. Like, you know what? Nothing in life is guaranteed. And I don't want to live life just like making decisions around something that may or may not ever happen. You know, I just want to live. And as a single person, and not even think about myself as like, oh, I'm living as a single person. I'm just living. And there's stuff in my life. And right now, a romantic relationship is not part of my life. And that is fine. And it may be one day, or it may never be. And that's also fine, you know, because it's really not about the circumstances that are going to bring the joy that we're looking for. Because I know so many married people who have everything they thought they wanted. They have the partner, the kids, the house, the car, the job, and they hate their lives, you know, and they're depressed and they're sad and they're lonely. And I know a lot of single people who are depressed and sad and lonely, and they think that marriage is going to fix it. And or there's married people who think, well, I got married too young, or maybe if I get divorced. And, you know, I'm like, it's not true. You know, like, it to me, it's all about your perspective. Having more or less money is not going to make you happy. Having a partner or not having a partner. I tell people all the time, if you're miserable single, you're going to be miserable married. If you miserable broke, you're going to be miserable rich. You know, like you gotta have yourself rooted in something more important than just circumstances that come and go, like, and that aren't firm and eternal. And, you know, it's like things can change, and I don't want my joy and my happiness in life to be completely dependent on someone else. Because what if that person dies? Or what if that person never shows up? Or what if that person, you know, changes and doesn't make me feel like they used, like they used to make me feel? Then what am I going to do? Well, now it's your fault that I'm not happy. No, that's not fair to put on somebody else, you know?
Yeah.
So, anyway, but that's the long-winded answer too. But yeah, anti-Valentine's Day is just kind of, it's just a fun thing to do. But also, I really do see it as an important event, annual event that I do to just remind people that, hey, it's all right. You know, even if you're not in a relationship, doesn't mean you don't have a community. Doesn't mean that you're not loved. Doesn't mean that your life isn't beautiful, and that you can't share that beauty with people.
Yeah. No, I love that. A, I find it encouraging, and B, I just want to print it out on a really long piece of paper. And whenever my extended family or friends ask me, that I can just hand them, like, here's my answer quoted from someone else.
Well, look, man, I would suggest, even if you can't make it out to Long Beach, California, that this year that you host your own anti-Valentine's Day open mic.
I have your blessing.
Do it, bro. Start the movement here.
All right. I feel very affirmed.
Yeah.
And I'm very happy. Micah, are you ready for the last segment of this interview? Rapid fire.
Kanye.
Oh, no. Here we go. Part two. No.
Right, go ahead. Ask me the question.
Who has 5 hours?
Bring them.
I'll leave you and Noah can sit here. I'll go get Slims. All right. Rapid fire. Here we go. Dua Lipa or Taylor Swift?
Ooh, why you do me like that, bro?
Because I know.
You ain't right. Next question.
Micah.
That's cold-blooded. You.
I knew what I was doing. If you had to write a song about how utterly fantastic my hair is, would you do it in spoken word, blues, or hip-hop? Look at it. Take a second.
Is your hair spoken word, blues, or hip-hop? I'm not getting a blues or hip hop vibe, so it would have to be spoken word.
All right, I'll take it. Polar bear versus grizzly bear. Go.
Oh, black bear.
I like it. Vancouver or Paris?
Oh, man, definitely Paris. Paris is gorgeous.
Will you ever wear overalls while performing on stage again?
Oh, totally.
Okay, okay.
Chance the Rapper Jack, my style. I did it way before Chance the Rapper.
Oh, yeah.
Tacos or chicken and waffles?
Oh, tacos.
All right. Why can't I stop crying when I look in the mirror? No one ever has an answer.
Yeah.
Finally, best way to spend a weekend, Micah?
best way to spend a weekend. I don't know. Go to open mic and eat some delicious food.
Yeah. Love it. Micah, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to come sit and chat with us. I really appreciate it. Again, it's been a very surreal thing for me. It's warmed my heart. Mm-hmm. If people want to have their hearts warmed more, where should they go to engage with your stuff? Where can they find you?
Yeah, I am all over the interwebs, but my website and my Instagram and my Facebook is all just my first and last name. It's Micah, M-I-C-A-H, Bournet, B-O-U-R-N-E-S, MicahBournet.com. And on my website, I have all of my releases are free downloads. So I have two spoken word albums. I have a blues album and I have a hip hop album. They're all free downloads through my website. You can also stream them on Spotify and Apple Music, and you also purchase them on iTunes and all the online stores and stuff like that. If you go to my website, you can also sign up to get emails from me that will keep you alerted when I release new material, new videos of poetry or music or books or anything like that. I'd love to stay connected to y'all. Follow me on Instagram. That's my favorite social media platform. Also, follow Fight Evil with Poetry. We have an Instagram and a website coming soon as well. So there's going to be a lot of cool stuff happening with all of those. So, yeah.
Fantastic. Well, Noah, thank you as always for joining me, co-hosting Absolutely. With me. It's always a pleasure to feast upon your baguette. Humming Fools, thank you
that.
For...
Don't I will ever say that again.
I will say it many
no,
more
what
times.
What are you talking about?
My goal besides...
Oh, no.
My goal is always to embarrass Noah.
How many times have you feasted upon Noah's baguette?
Do you see? Do you see that face? That's why I do this.
He's
That's
a
why
married man.
Oh, Kyle.
You're welcome, internet. Yeah. Anyway, have a good night, you guys. See you later.
Bye.